Hi, I'm Ken Carroll. These recordings are provided by ChinesePod.com.
This is a Learning 2.08 conference podcast. This and all conference conversations recorded live in September 2008.
All right, still needed some refining. So that set me down the path of doing some more research on, all right, so how do you actually teach story? And that's what you'll find me spending more of my time talking about today. And it's also why this website, teachstory.org, this is where I have a lot of my information, different projects that I've done over the years. But the other one, the wiki, and the other blog, that was back here, this has my best set of links there. And this I'll be updating. There still really isn't one place, I think, for teachers to go to get fantastic resources for digital storytelling. There are many people. David Jakes has a fantastic website. There are many people, Vernon Jean Porter, Jason Oler. Many people have fantastic websites with resources, but you know, they have an educational link there. But there still isn't one place where we can go to where we can kind of get ideas and get strategies for figuring out how do we do this well, you know, and how do we go to a one place where we can get more than just a link on, you know, an iMovie tutorial. So that's what I'm moving towards. So today we're talking about the 7 steps of the digital storytelling project. You'll find that today I'll spend more of my time talking about this first part, writing the script. Because if you don't have a story, I think we all know, you're going to waste a whole lot of time. Over the years, I've seen many people that are interested in digital storytelling, but in what they were really interested in was learning iMovie or learning the technical side. And that's fine, but I found that their end products, you know, while they were flashy and they looked like they were progressing along their technical skills, they weren't really achieving their academic goals. They weren't really helping to improve students' literacy skills, and they weren't really helping the kids learn the material that they had hoped to. So you'll hear me talk probably a majority of what I'm going to talk about over the next 20 minutes and talk about is, all right, so how do we get at that that first stage? How do we create good stories? How do we help students write good stories? And while a lot of this material I'm talking about is geared for teachers, I'm still, these are the 7 steps that you're going to approach if you were doing this just on your own. So these are our 7 steps we're going to go through. But you really could break it down even more. You'll talk to different people, they're like, no, it's really 4 steps. Well, you know, the reason why it's 7 steps is this started, I'll talk a little bit about the Center for Digital Storytelling. They were one of the first organizations, Joe Lambert, Nina Mullen, and Dana Ashley, that kind of coined that phrase and got started. And these were their first kind of 7 steps that they started sharing. And then teachers over time said, well, you know what? This is really what it's about, you know? Once you have your story, you get your pictures, or you create your pictures, you create your media, get it into the computer, get your voiceover, and then get on the computer and sync everything. That's, in a nutshell, what you have to do to create a digital story. Now, I also say, just because you go through all 5 of those steps, doesn't mean it's a quality digital story. And that's what we're going to spend a good amount of time talking about also. So, also a little bit more on how I got into this with my 4th graders. They were working on some different storytelling activities, and at the same time, that year, the iMovie program was introduced. I was looking at kind of multimedia storytelling and figuring out how can I use traditional oral storytelling and puppetry and the creative arts with my students. And then the iMovie program comes along, and I was doing some stuff with computers, and I was like, you know what? I wonder if I can combine these two. You know, the engagement of storytelling with the engagement of technology. And, you know, even before the technology part, you know, in all of my teaching, I hadn't found anything that was as engaging as storytelling. That when I was giving kids opportunities to tell, you know, personal short stories, or when I was trying to teach through story, I had all their attention. And when I turned it over for that first time, for that first digital storytelling project, and I asked them, tell me a story about a place that's important to you. Not one kid raised their hand and said, Mr. Banaszewski, I don't get it. What do you mean? Every single kid got it, and they started writing, and they, you know, they had that instant connection to a story. So that was really important in developing that play story project. And after working on that for a couple of years, that's when I decided to kind of go back and do some more research. But before that, it was Dana Ashley's Next Exit project that when I was still researching multimedia storytelling, Dana Ashley was an artist and performer, community organizer working with Joe Lambert in San Francisco. And he had this great kind of live performance piece where he had, he was an Apple developer also, he had coded this program where it allowed him to take movies that he had created over time, and he had them synced up on, you know, this huge screen behind him. So all he had was a wireless mouse, a headset, and a fake kind of campfire. It was a TV with a campfire rolling on screen. And I saw that on the web, and I'm like, I gotta go see that, I gotta go to this. And it was the Digital Storytelling Festival that year in Colorado, and I went out there. I was fortunate to see that was his last performance. He passed away later that year. And I came back from that trying to figure out, all right, this works for adults, the Center for Digital Storytelling model, I get that, but how do you break this down for school teachers and elementary school kids? And that's when I started working on, all right, how do you adapt that model? One of the biggest things in digital storytelling, though, is defining it. And everyone, not everyone, but many people have different ideas of what is a digital story. I'm going to show you five different media pieces. And off of the wiki, if you're able to get there, there are almost four of the five are there also under the defining digital storytelling. I'd like, if you can get on there, just to comment on each one, if you think they match or they represent these seven elements. So this also came out of the Center for Digital Storytelling. And again, this has been revised by other people. But when we talk about the seven elements of a digital story, what are we looking at? Well, do we have a point of view? Is it coming from one individual's perspective? Or is it clear that somebody, you know, is directing the point of view? This, I think, is the most important part. And it also can get pretty confusing when you shift digital storytelling into an academic setting. What is the dramatic question? Now, we're not talking about huge kind of, you know, Shakespearean drama here. You know, for the classroom, you know, the question is, you know, that we want students to answer is, so what? So you want to create a digital story? In that digital story, you've got to answer the question for whatever the topic is, so what? Why do I care? What do you have to say? And that's what we're getting at for a dramatic question. There should be emotional content in there. If your digital story is just regurgitating facts, I don't think you're doing much to help kids develop their literacy skills. If all they're going to do is go to Wikipedia or go to somewhere on the web and copy and paste it in there and just recite it, while there is some, you know, some benefit there in developing their oral language skills, it's that I don't feel is digital storytelling. And you'll see a couple there that break from the traditional kind of story model. I'm going to talk a bit more about that. And it's up to you, I think, to determine, you know, is it a story, and does it, more importantly, match or have as many of these elements as possible. So emotional content, we're not talking about, you know, tugging at the heartstrings, but many of them do. But I think it comes back to, does your digital story make a point? Do you get your point across? Is it effective communication? Individual voice, there are group projects, but is there a clear individual voice that, you know, are there I statements in there? Can you tell that somebody cares about this topic? Soundtrack, that just means is music, you know, being used effectively in there? It doesn't have to be a part of every single digital story. And economy, digital stories are meant to be compact. They're not to be these long opus, you know, type projects. They shouldn't be longer than 5 minutes, because in reality, can you think of anything that you've watched online longer than 5 minutes that really held your attention? And that's really important to keep in mind for any type of multimedia product that kids produce. Even for like film schools, you know, you're not going to ask a student, a high school student even, in a film class to produce anything longer, you know, than like 7-10 minutes. That's hard, okay? So digital stories are meant to be compact. You know, if you're just starting out with young kids, you know, 1 minute is a lot. You know, being able to deal with 1 minute and being able to have a story that engages somebody for 1 minute is a lot of time. Pacing. So, in this, you know, comes to the point of, can you do this? Bernard Jean Porter talks about this is what we're asking kids to do. This is what encompasses, I believe, our 21st century skills. You know, we hear that buzzword, but I think this is a clear example of what we mean when we're asking kids to create a digital story that really works and effectively communicates. We want them to get their images, and use text and audio and their voice. And when it's up on the screen, they've figured out to get that balance right. And they have the pacing of how long an image stays on the screen, the pacing of their voice, how long a piece of music comes in at the beginning and end. Those, you know, and those are skills I think that carry across all the disciplines. Doesn't matter if it's a science class or language arts. When we're asking kids to effectively communicate, and we ask kids to create PowerPoints or podcasts or iMovies or digital stories, this is what we're asking them to do. And what I found, and I was guilty of this for many years, how many people use HyperStudio? Remember that? Well, HyperStudio was the kind of multimedia production tool that was used in my class. And a lot of times, I saw teachers, and myself included, were asking kids to, well, create a HyperStudio project about rainforests. And what they were doing was kind of regurgitating facts. They were not telling a story. And they were getting lost in being able to link buttons and have a clear navigation scheme. And I realized, wait a second, well, first, I didn't teach them any of those things. I didn't teach them how to tell a good story with media, and I didn't teach them, really how to do those specific visual and media literacy skills. So, all right, so let's take a look at these five. And again, this handout is also off of the wiki. You'll see it under resources, and so if you want to open it up and have it there. But for each of them that I play, they're a couple minutes long. But try to keep in mind, as you're watching them, all right, do they have these elements? And do you think it matches your definition of a digital story? And I purposely haven't put up what I feel is my definition of a digital story, because I want to see I want you to apply what you think is a digital story to these five. All right, so let's take a look. Wonderful. Where did the audio go? Where did that little okay. It was working. That's all there. Audio. Does anyone see the tech person out there? All right, so. Let's try.
Because
there's one. Oh, this one connects. You get a set of external speakers. Anyone have a set of external speakers?
Well, I'm not sure they have speakers.
As soon as I plug this in,
on a cold water pipe.
All right, we're back in the.
Yay!
No, don't touch anything. Thank you. All right, thank you for your patience on that. Let's try this again. So, probably now I'll only be able to show about four. Take a look, see if these match your definition of a digital store.
The country. I wondered about you when you told me never to leave a box of wooden strike anywhere matches just lying around the house because the mice might get into them and start a fire. But your face was absolutely straight when you twisted the lid down on the round tin where the matches, you said, are always stowed. Who could sleep that night? Who could whisk away the thought of the one unlikely mouse padding along a cold water pipe behind the floral wallpaper, gripping a single wooden match between the needles of his teeth? Who could not see him rounding a corner, the blue tip scratching against a rough-hewn beam, the sudden flare, and the creature, for one bright, shining moment, suddenly thrust ahead of his time, now a fire starter, now a torchbearer in a forgotten ritual, little brown druid illuminating some ancient night. And who could fail to notice, lit up in the blazing insulation, the tiny looks of wonderment on the faces of his fellow mice, one-time inhabitants of what once was your house in the country.
All right.
Ethiopia is where they say the Garden of Eden was. Some even say the Ark of Covenant was there. When Zom came to see the Queen of Sheba was Ethiopian. The ancient country has millions of proud and noble people. Then why, today, does the average life expectancy rate only go up to a mere 47.7 years old? You cannot help but wonder why these people are in the midst of this silent tsunami, attacking Ethiopia and other countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Ironically, Ethiopia is facing a food crisis when crop production has risen by 45% in the past 5 years. But now, Ethiopia has faced, and still is facing, a series of dangerous droughts in the last year, leaving crops dry and water dirty. Without a source of clean water and food, Ethiopians are forced to survive without anything but what they can find. Right now, 1 million Ethiopians are on the brink of death, urgently needing resources to survive on. 29 schools have been forced to close, and more than 4,000 children have dropped out of school in the Borana district due to severe climatic conditions, loss of loved ones, the incapability of supporting oneself, and migration by the local community. Ethiopia's economy is faltering even after the aid provided after the 1984 famine, which left the country in devastation. Now, 77% of the population can only withstand spending less than $2 a day. Since staple food prices shoot to the top in inflation, it is almost impossible for the average Ethiopian to afford nutritious and clean food. With the drought, thousands of animals have died since the beginning of this year, and livestock deaths have reached alarming levels. Malnutrition weakens the children's ability to resist the attacks of infectious diseases, and with the death of milking cattle, nutrients for these children in Ethiopia became scarce. It has been estimated that malnutrition is a factor in 50% of all incidents under 5 mortality. Already, more than 50% of the population of Ethiopia is malnourished, and only half have access to safe drinking water. The ever-rising numbers are putting more pressure on the exhausted land, pushing people further up to the mountains to the margin of fertility. Thin soil is exhausted. The trees that bound it to the hillsides have long since been chopped down for firewood. When it is dry, it just blows away as dust, and when it rains, the topsoil is swirled away by rivers. All Ethiopia's rivers run dark brown. This can only mean less food and water for the people, resulting in death, not of natural causes, but of disease and famine. filthy water is consumed by Ethiopians, but since health services are on...
All right, I'm going to stop that one there. I think you did. Just that one.
I was thinking about your funeral the other day. I was 11. Everyone said it was something of a relief since you had been so ill. Still, it was hard to lose one of my best friends. I don't remember what was said at the funeral. I was thinking of my overnight stays at your house, just the two of us, of eating peanut butter and honey sandwiches cut into quarters on the porch, of little jars of M&Ms, and your big black purse that always had lifesavers in it, of how sorry I felt when you'd say, "Oh, where did the good Matthew go? I miss him so much." Since then, I've learned much more about your life. You were actually young once, the daughter of Danish immigrants. You yearned to see the world beyond your small Utah town. You started your teaching career at 18. You, my dignified grandmother, engaged in youthful antics and even eloped to Nevada and then lied about it. You moved to California, had three kids, and raised them by yourself after Grandpa died. When you resumed teaching in the late 1940s, you were assigned to a segregated school for black and Mexican children in Monrovia. I share your outrage at the conditions you found there, at the racist practices that kept these kids invisible and forgotten. As a teacher, and later as principal, you fought to improve the school, hire a diverse, dedicated staff, and give the children first-class educational experience. Most importantly, you cared about the kids, even loved them. You knew their names and their families. You had high expectations for them, and they responded. One went on to become the town's first minority school board president. Another, its first black mayor. I know from your letters and writings how exhausting it was to fight the status quo day after day for 17 years. And it took a toll on you. But you did it because it was the right thing to do. I have another memory of your funeral, a vision of the large and diverse crowd in attendance. I was barely aware of them at the time. The little boy in me still doesn't want to share you with all those people. But as a historian and a citizen, as your grandson and a father of my own children, I wish to join with the others 24 years after the fact and say thank you.
My name is Tom Banaszewski. I was told by my junior high gym teacher that it's pronounced Banaszewski in Polish. What a jerk that guy was, telling me how to pronounce my own name. But the truth was, he was the first person to teach me anything about my background, other than the collection of Polish jokes a friend had given me as a birthday present. I knew nothing about my last name. I'm 37 years old. I had lived my whole life in the United States until moving to Shanghai last year. For the last 15 years, I've been an elementary and middle school teacher and loved every minute of it. One day I'll never forget was during a small reading group discussion about a book on immigration. I got the students asking that question. They turned to each other and casually asked, "So what are you?" Jessica said to Sarah, "You're Jewish, aren't you?" Jimmy volunteered that he was half Irish, a part Italian, and a little bit Czechoslovakian. They continued their own conversations, noticing that Jessica, who had just left the group, was whispering in my ear, "Mr. B, what am I?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, I know I'm Japanese from my mom's side, but my dad's dad died before he could find out." I encouraged Jessica to talk to her parents, who at the last conference appeared to have Asian, Hispanic, and African heritage. But of course, I wasn't about to interfere in how Jessica would identify herself. That would be her journey. My parents were not immigrants. Neither were most of my grandparents. My father's grandparents, Joseph John Banaszewski and Mary Filarecki, left Płock, Poland in 1898 to avoid the Russian army requirement that Polish men serve 2 years in the Red Army. Poles were always sent to Siberia and often lost fingers and toes to the extreme cold. My father grew up in a house where eating kielbasa and pierogies at Christmas was the only reminder of his Polish heritage. His mother, an Irish immigrant who left County Cork at the turn of the century, brought only her fervent devotion to the Roman Catholic Church with her. My mother grew up in an industrious house, but it was void of ethnic and religious definition. She knew nothing of her German ancestors and cared even less, even though her grandmother lived 4 blocks away while growing up. So naturally, I grew up in a house where my parents never talked about culture, ethnicity, or anything to do with our background. They passed away before I could ask, "Where are we from?" along with many other questions. My culture is a culture of loss, which is why I don't allow people to call me Mr. B. I can control that part of my heritage. I don't speak a word of Polish. Eating pierogies and smoked kielbasa at Christmas is as close as I come to my Polish roots. But I don't want to lose my only link to my past just because someone struggles to pronounce my last name. It's been working with my new students. They see me in the halls of the school and stop to show me that they can pronounce my last name. But I still overhear the younger kids asking each other, "So, what are you?" And each time there's a kid who has that lost look of not knowing what is being asked of them. I hope that Jessica has also found that at some point you choose how important your background is to you. You decide how many questions you want to ask.
All right, so I'm gonna, in amazingly 15 minutes, step us through how did we get to that point. But before that, can go back to our definition of story. So we saw a few different ones, both class projects, individual ones, adult ones, student ones. And when I think about defining a digital story, the key part here, not so much that it's autobiographical, but it has a narrative. And that it has, you know, a personal narrative. It doesn't have to follow the traditional, you know, kind of English model of a personal narrative. But it's more than just beginning, middle, and end. You know, it has that story arc to it. And that's the other challenge in defining digital storytelling. This was, well, a lot of times people don't have a clear definition of story. All right, a lot of times they think, yeah, all right, beginning, middle, and end. But I try to work from Kendall Haven's definition. And if you're interested, his book there is fantastic. And I think this is what complicates, you know, effective accomplishment of developing students' digital literacy skills. You know, this is what we're trying to go for. I think digital storytelling, when it's done well and effectively, is going to develop these types of skills for students. You know, and we hear our buzzwords of 21st century skills, but this, I believe, is what we're talking about. And if you want to do that, well, first, you have to approach and you have to teach kids story. You have to be working at their story literacy skills, and it goes along with their media and visual literacy skills. Too often, and you'll notice, I didn't put up here technical literacy, all right? Because that's what happens too often. And we teach kids how to use a piece of software, but we don't teach them these three very important domains of skills that cover so many parts of using that software. And you know, when we are doing that well, this is what we're looking at. It's, you know, these specific types of skills. You know, and again, you know, that buzzword, and people are like, well, what do we mean? I think this is what we're talking about. You know, we're looking at developing students that are knowledgeable designers, they can compose, and they're producers of, you know, well, I would add in there, effective visual information. We've all sat through horrible, painful PowerPoint presentations because we ask kids to create visual, you know, to visually present the information. But we haven't taught them, all right? We haven't taught them how to tell a good story. We haven't taught them how to use the images appropriately. So that first step there, when we're talking about, you know, creating a story, if you don't believe this, don't go near digital storytelling, okay? Because you're just gonna frustrate yourself, because I feel this is what should motivate you. And if you do skip over that, this is what's gonna happen. Well, and if you skip over the other parts of teaching the media and visual literacy, you're gonna get kids that don't know the difference between just a slideshow and a digital story and a multimedia report. And I'm not saying you can't do multimedia reports, that's fine, okay? Just be clear that that's what you're asking kids to do, okay? And this is the big part. We're teachers, we need to, you know, be accountable, we have to hold the kids accountable. But too often, assessment becomes subjective if you haven't taught those specific skills. And this step, the first step, becomes very challenging because we don't teach storytelling, you know, and the traditional storytelling skills, you know, we've drifted, you know, from that in our culture. And we're also still wedded to our traditional composition approaches. You know, we still follow, telling kids it's got to follow this format. Well, you know, it's a shift for a digital storytelling script because, you know, like that quote of dancing text and images on the screen, it's that balance, all right? So it's also challenging because this is not part of most people's definition of story. You know, when we ask kids to tell a story, and this happens time and again, I ask kids, hey, tell me a story. Like, well, what do you mean? Oh, just tell me a story about an important event in your life. I don't know. And I think, you know, we do a great disservice to graduate kids that don't have this as a basic understanding of story, and that don't have the ability to, you know, introduce an idea, you know, a story, a personal event, develop it with tension, see where the climax is, you know, resolve that, and then in the end wrap it up with, oh, well, you know, this is what I learned from it. So there are many ways still that you can get at a good story. For that particular story that I showed you, it was a response to an open-ended question that a teacher had asked me. So Tom, you know, what's your culture? And that's how I responded to it. You're looking at concise moments of change, you know, for the particular personal narrative, and that still applies, I think, to the more content-driven type of stories. Be specific. Do not tell a student, or do not assign a student to create a digital story after you've completed a unit on whatever, okay? Because
You're just gonna, you're inviting regurgitating facts, okay? These are a couple other, these are linked off of the wiki there, the idea of a story spine. And story sparks comes from J. O'Callaghan. How many people know J. O'Callaghan? Again, this is a great sadness. J. O'Callaghan is one of the master oral storytellers in the United States. He's performed around the world in all the prestigious places. He is a master oral storyteller. And he's been on NPR a bunch of times, but not enough. You know, it's my bias that people like that, that is a lost art. That is great skill. And that's not part of mainstream media. And there's a lot to learn from that. I think that students, when they hear a story presented like that, they can learn a lot from it. All right. So in this first stage, when you're approaching writing your story, I don't go anywhere near writing the script yet until I have a clear sense of what is my main conflict that I'm trying to resolve. And then I'm working from there. What's the dramatic question? Jason Oler uses this idea of a VPS, the virtual or the visual portrait of a story. And again, this is far before storyboarding. This is asking kids, to visualize what do you see going on in your story and getting a sense of where is kind of the emotional flow of the story. So for that one, for that story that I just showed you, here's the VPS for it. In the beginning, Joseph Campbell type of the power of myth language, the call to adventure. Well, for me, it was, I didn't know anything about my background, and that main question of, well, what are you? Of course, I got my last name, but, So it increases in my particular case. Well, nobody talked about our family and our background. So the story tension, escalates there. And then the main conflict there is that, well, once my parents passed away, I can't ask them. I have to, kind of figure that out on my own. More tension. Well, people shorten my name. Happens all the time. I see it happen in schools. Somebody has a long last name. They chop it off there. They're like, oh, don't worry about it. I'm like, and then 4 months into the year, people have no idea what your last name is. And I'm like, yeah, that's wrong. So in this case, as you start to resolve the story, I make sure that people at least know my last name. Don't allow them to call me Mr. B. And so the resolution there is, well, I feel good. I got that message across. But here's the most important part. And you can almost, it's hard to kind of work backwards from this, but if you're approaching it from, well, in the end, what's the main change? And then you're writing your story from there. In this case, there's this, it's not a huge transformation, but for me, it's, all right, there's peace that, all right, this is how I'm going to maintain my link, to my culture. All right? So now that I have my VPS, I can move on to storyboarding. This one is also off of the wiki. I find this is the best one because I can do a little pencil sketch of what I want, and I don't have to write the whole voiceover, but I can put some notes in there. Now that I have my storyboard, I'm ready to go on to writing the script. And it's not gonna be, the five paragraph essay. You're looking at concise, writing, and this is why it's hard, because kids are used to five paragraphs, writing good paragraphs. And now we're asking them, well, no, you don't have to write a huge five paragraph essay. What we want you to write is, kind of clear, clear statements that are gonna go along with visuals. So I have my script, and for the planning stage, and I could talk a whole another hour on this, but I'm just gonna say, if you're gonna run a digital storytelling project with your students, with anybody, go through it yourself. Obviously create a digital story on your own, but create it in the environment that you plan to run the workshop. And that's gonna help you do all of your planning. On here, so I don't have to show you, but getting organized, you create some folders. This is gonna help you. If you're using a Mac and you're using the whole iLife suite, you don't have to do that because it's all integrated. All right, but if you should still create a backup on a little flash drive, because you invest all that time in your project. If something happens, it's always good to have a backup there. But I have a folder that I have all my original images. I'm gonna resize them and I'll put them in there. And I have my voiceover and then any music I'm collecting. And then in the end, I export it and keep them all there. So, voiceover. Let's just jump into, oh boy. I did not successfully get to everything. How many people use iMovie? Okay. Unfortunately, I don't have 15 minutes, but I can teach everything, 85% of the program in actually about 15 minutes, even less, but I'll do it in two. Let me just open up the
There are three main things to understand in any program that you're going to use to create a digital story, whether it is iMovie, Photo Story, or Movie Maker. And the first concept is, how do you get the information into the computer? That is important. You have your media, you have your image files, and you need to tell it, all right, I want to put it in here. iMovie, when it comes in, it's going to be over here on the shelf, and I'm just going to say import, and I have my folder already set up there. I've already put my images in there. I'm going to import them all at the same time. And now they're all going to be there. The default is going to be 5 seconds, and that's how long it stays on the screen. So this is our first step, importing them. And this is once you already have your images. Normally, you wouldn't be at this stage yet. You would either be working on your voiceover. A quick thing about the steps, they're not all linear. I mean, you can be working on your voiceover at the same time that you're working on gathering images. Right? So don't be confused on it's this regimented process. So we have our images there in iMovie. This is called the shelf. It's going to be the same in almost any program where you have bins. And the next thing is you just need to learn is drag and drop. And that's the idea of taking your media and putting it down here on your timeline. This is perhaps the most challenging concept to kind of get across, that you can control everything down here. You can control it down to the hundredth of a second. And so that means as I start to build, and I'm going to drop it there, I'm going to switch into storyboard mode because you're going to create your rough cut first. You have your images in. I'm not so concerned about knowing exactly everything, but I'm going to have my storyboard. I have my storyboard to guide me, and I know that I have that one. That's going to be there. I know that that's going to be there also. All right? But switching back here in the timeline mode, that's where you're going to do your editing. But this is perhaps the hardest thing to get across to anybody that's new to iMovie or to any of the programs. It's just getting comfortable with controlling that. Okay? But you can control every second. And the more that you zoom in, the more detail. All right, so we have our images in there. And let's see. The voiceover is going to be perhaps your most time-consuming part. There are many ways to approach this. On the any Mac, you can record it right in there. Okay? See how it's picking up my voice? And you'd be surprised. It just, the quality of that. I'm going to switch back over here into timeline mode. This is the playhead. This is the other way of controlling how you move around. I'll often zoom out all the way so I can see everything. Okay. And just to show you, so if I wanted to record in there, that's my record button. And if I start up, I was told by my junior high gym teacher that it's pronounced Banaszewski in Polish. One more time to stop. Let's hear how that sounds. I was told by my junior high gym teacher that it's pronounced Banaszewski in Polish. So the quality of the new Macs, the internal microphone, is actually pretty good. But if you happen to have a nice USB microphone, sure, use it. It's going to be better. But you know what? You don't need that greater quality. You can get away with a nice little, $5 or actually $5 here. A little lavalier mic. But if you have a nice USB mic, you're going to get better quality. And if you have the Mac, the Snowball, or what's the new one called? They came out with one that's a little bit smaller. But these mics, what's great about them is that they're USB powered, so you don't need to carry around all extra big power packs. And so I'm going to delete our test one there. Go back one more time. And you record again. I was told by my junior
high. Our podcast comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card and services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
I have no idea where that's coming from.
From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Right Way.
Oh, I see. Up there. Anyway, that was cool. All right, that one's going. And let me just then, I'm going to skip over to one that's midway through.
And I apologize, I did not get to all of my steps there. And if you need to go to another session, that's fine, I'll stay. But again, during the unconference, so for the last session, I'll be available. I don't know if this room is, but I'll come back and I'll answer any technical questions. So the other part then, so I told you the 85% in 2 minutes, taught you 65%. You have images in, you learned how to drag and drop, how to record audio. The other thing you need to learn now is how long can you make something stay on the screen? And this is where I think iMovie beats any other program, because it is far easier to take this little image here, and I'm going to tell it, you know what? No, it needs to be a little bit shorter, because I can listen to the audio clip there.
Christmas is as close.
And I know that I can change that. And that is the easiest way to edit. You can do things up here too, and changing the length. That is 85% of the iMovie program, and once you can do that, you can pretty much do, you can complete a digital storytelling project. The other 15%, that's getting finer in terms of your editing, that's using video. You'll notice I didn't include video in there because I feel that if you can't create a good slideshow, don't have kids go anywhere near video. Video has a whole other set of skills that you want to make sure kids can use still images properly first. So, all right, let's just see all the things that I did not get to. Recording, voice, a rough cut I sort of did. And so this is, perhaps, I'm sure something people are very interested in when you're done. All right, what can you do with it? You can export it in in different formats. You can put it up on YouTube. And you can see I put a bunch of them there. I'll put that link off the wiki too. But again, I'll be available to cover all of that. And so I'm sorry that that we just didn't have enough time.
Did you say you're going to do an unconference? I will
do the unconference. What is that? Session 7. Okay. And I'll go post that on that there. The PowerPoint is all off of that wiki there. And that's at the beginning. So that one's there. There's also another PowerPoint that has a bit more detail on looking at developing digital storytelling within your curriculum. So that's all there, and thank you for your time, and maybe I'll see some of you in the conference. Also, if you want to see some of the other books, and I get no royalties on this, but this is this has been my best resource, Jason Oler's. Bernie Jean Porter's book, and then the beginning is Joe Lambert's and the Sons of Jesus book. But those are also linked all off the
Great.
Right there.
This and all Learning 2.08 podcasts are released under a Creative Commons 3.0 share alike license. To learn more about the Learning 2.08 conference, visit our website at learning2cn.ning.com.